Tonight's topic for Jonathan Boston is Laudato Si, the plea from Pope Francis to protect humanity's common home. And when introducing Jonathan, it's more a case of what to leave out of a biography. Jonathan has had a stellar career. He's professor of public policy at Victoria University and previously served as director of the Institute for Governance and Policy Studies. I think I've got that right. Yeah. And he's published widely, too many to name, in fields of public policy, public management, comparative government. And he is a highly influential and respected in the policy field in New Zealand and also around the world. So I welcome you, Jonathan. Thanks very much.
Well, tēnā koutou katoa. Thank you, Murray, for your welcome. Thank you all for coming. And as Murray has said, this event has been possible only through the hard work of many people, and I'd just like to echo Murray's thanks to the various people that have contributed in various ways, including Andrew Shepherd, who of course is not here tonight, sadly. Talking about hearing aids and hearing problems, some years ago, one of my uncles had a great aunt who died, and she was very, very wealthy, and the whole family gathered around for the reading of the will. And the lawyer read the will out, and the aunt had written, "Being of sound mind, I have given all my estate to the deaf, the Society for the Deaf," or something like that. And my uncle was reported to have said, "Pardon? What was that?" Anyway. That's apocryphal, probably. I don't know. But anyway, here we go. I have prepared a full paper for this event, and there are a few copies left on the table. I'm very happy to email people electronic versions if you would like one. I have not prepared any PowerPoint slides, so I'm sorry. For those who prefer to be entertained with visual forms of one kind, you'll just have to put up with this particular general slide. But I thought on this occasion I would prepare a formal paper and read it. So that's what I'm going to do. I also just like to say a number of people commented on our draft, including Andrew, and I was very grateful for their contributions. So how many of you have actually read Laudato Si? So quite a few of you here, and I know a number of people said they hadn't quite finished it, so I said, well, it's not too long to finish, so there's one sort of version of it. So let me start with the problem. Humanity has failed to love, cherish, and protect God's creation. We have not been wise stewards of the earth's resources. We have failed to exercise proper prudence, anticipate and mitigate risks, and take adequate precautionary measures. We now face a grave ecological crisis. According to leading scientists, we are exceeding critical planetary boundaries, most notably with respect to biodiversity loss and climate change. And time is running out. In short, our economies are environmentally unsustainable, our ecological footprints are too large, and our carbon emissions are excessive. We are borrowing from the future and leaving our children and grandchildren a terrible legacy, a huge, unsustainable ecological debt, and colossal, irreversible damage. In response to this serious ecological crisis, Pope Francis published an encyclical letter, which most of you are aware of, on the 18th of June 2015, known as Laudato Si. It is a significant and deeply moving letter. It outlines how humanity has been failing, as Pope Francis puts it, to, quote, care for our common home, to care for our common home. So in what follows, I will summarize the contents of Laudato Si. I will then consider the encyclical's strengths and weaknesses and endeavor to provide a sympathetic critique. I will conclude, if I have time, with some brief reflections on how humanity can better protect our common home. two caveats need emphasis at the outset. First, I cannot do justice to Laudato Si in the brief time available. It is a substantial document, some 246 paragraphs, close to 50,000 words, and it traverses numerous theological, biblical, ethical, cultural, scientific, political, and policy matters. I could readily spend an entire lecture on any one of these topics, and even then really only scratch the surface. Second, I will not dwell in length on the scope, scale, or gravity of the current ecological crisis. I'll assume that the basic problems are well understood by those here tonight. But obviously they include, amongst other things, widespread habitat destruction and degradation, air, land, and water pollution, ozone depletion, soil erosion and desertification, the over-exploitation of very scarce natural resources, climate change and the related problem of ocean acidification, and massive deforestation, which continues apace. Globally, the species extinction rate is now estimated to be 1,000 times above the natural background rate, and we have entered the early stages of the sixth great mass extinction event on this planet in the last 540 million years. Such events are where more than 50% of the planet's species are destroyed. As the OECD argued in a major report a few years ago, humanity faces a risk of, I quote, irreversible changes that could endanger two centuries of rising living standards. Aotearoa New Zealand is not immune. Our environmental problems include deteriorating water quality, the over-allocation of scarce freshwater resources in some areas, a significant per capita carbon footprint, which has not been going down, poor land use management with soil loss estimated at 10 times the global average, weak marine governance, the threats to many native species, and much more. Since human settlement, New Zealand has lost something like 85% of our indigenous forests, over 50 bird species, many of those before colonial settlement, and 90% of its wetlands, together with, obviously, as you know, a high proportion of our rivers now being polluted. So any suggestion that these islands are clean and green is patently false. Well, turning then to Laudato Si. The encyclical begins with an overview of the current global ecological crisis, and drawing on the statements and insights of former popes and Christian saints, especially St. Francis of Assisi, it highlights why human beings should care for creation. This first part is essentially the pope's, I think, kind of overview and plea to humanity. Then in chapter 1, Laudato Si outlines what is happening to our planet and discusses recent economic and social trends. It focuses especially on pollution and climate change, the degradation of water resources, the loss of biodiversity, the decline in the quality of human life, the weakening of societal bonds, the growth of income and wealth inequality in many parts of the world, and the failure of governments to act as wise environmental stewards. The fundamental argument in this chapter is that humanity faces both an environmental crisis and a social crisis, and that the two are inextricably linked. Next, chapter 2 outlines the Pope's gospel of creation, as he calls it. He discusses the doctrine of creation, relevant biblical sources, the mystery of life, the value, interconnectedness, and indivisibility of every part of the created order, and the subordination of private property to the universal destination of all things. He also reflects on the significance of the incarnation, obviously the life, teaching, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And he emphasizes God's intimate relationship with nature and the model that Jesus provides in living in harmony with creation. Turning to chapter 3, the encyclical reflects on the human roots of the ecological crisis. In so doing, it discusses the role of the technological paradigm, the contribution of globalization, the impact of rampant individualism, and what he calls an excessive anthropocentrism. The misguided Promethean vision of humanity's mastery over the world, the culture of relativism, and he highlights the importance of employment, vocation, as well as touching on various ethical issues such as those connected with biotechnology, genetic modification, and so forth. In chapter 4, the Pope addresses the critical importance of what he calls an integral ecology or an economic ecology. That is, an approach which respects the human and social dimensions of the economic world. As he puts it, we urgently need a humanism capable of bringing together the different fields of knowledge, including economics, in the service of a more integral and integrating vision. The chapter goes on to discuss what he calls authentic development, an integral improvement in the quality of human life, and the pursuit of the common good. And of course, the common good is at the heart of much Catholic social teaching. Following this, chapter 5 turns to the question of how, from a governmental or policy perspective, humanity should address the ecological crisis. Significantly, Pope Francis criticizes the recent emphasis in many countries on market-based solutions, such as emissions trading schemes, and he urges governments to ensure that the environmental effects of various human activities are properly taken into account in all aspects of economic development. And I'm going to return to this point of Pope Francis's criticism of market-based solutions later in my talk. The final chapter, entitled Ecological Education and Spirituality, focuses on the need for what Pope John Paul II, his predecessor, called an ecological conversion. This entails changes in lifestyle, habits, and beliefs, including the need for greater moderation, sobriety, and humility, free from an obsession with consumption and consumerism. The encyclical also calls for better environmental education and the development of a new ecological citizenship, one marked by a deep gratitude for the gifts of creation, the celebration of rest, and the abiding hope in the Sabbath of eternity when God will make all things new, as Revelation tells us, and where every creature is resplendently transfigured. To quote the encyclical, living our vocation to be protectors of God's handiwork is essential to a life of virtue. It is not an optional or a secondary aspect of our Christian experience. It is fundamental. And then the encyclical, as many of you will know, finishes with two very beautiful and thoughtful prayers, which I know have been quite widely used around the world by Christians. All right, so that's a quick overview. Now let me turn to an assessment and provide you with some judgments from me about some of the positive and not so positive aspects of the encyclical. As many of you will be aware, the encyclical has generated numerous commentaries and critiques. Unsurprisingly, many of these have been written by Christian scholars, particularly Catholics. Often these have focused on the extent to which Laudato Si is consistent with or departs from long-standing Christian doctrines, and especially Catholic social teaching. Many commentaries, however, have been from those with no apparent religious affiliations, in some cases distinguished scholars from leading academic institutions around the world. And this, to me, is significant. Most documents published by religious leaders are largely ignored by the secular press and by academics. They are not normally reviewed in The Guardian or the New York Review of Books. Laudato Si is a clear exception. And many will be aware that a great deal has now been published about the encyclical. Notwithstanding that, I was rather surprised just this week when I indicated to a very senior academic in my institution who is a Christian that I was going to be speaking on the encyclical at this event. This person had no knowledge of the encyclical. He was completely oblivious. And so we must never assume that even if things get into The Guardian or the New York Review of Books or whatever, that that means that the academic community, including Christians, are aware of it. All right, so there is much to commend in the encyclical. It is deeply rooted, obviously, in Christian theology. It is strongly Trinitarian and Christological. It contains many strikingly beautiful passages and evocative images. And Nicola, in her lecture this afternoon, quoted some of those wonderful passages. It is mostly lucidly written. It is passionate, and it's, in my view, readily accessible. It creatively weaves together a multiplicity of ideas, themes, and issues, and provides a comprehensive overview of the challenges currently facing humanity, particularly the environmental challenges. It offers powerful theological and ethical reasons for caring for creation. It recognizes the power of sin, both individual and structural. Likewise, it takes seriously the compelling scientific evidence regarding the current ecological crisis, especially climate change, and highlights the need for urgent responses by governments, businesses, and individuals. It offers a thoughtful and distinctively Christian perspective on the causes of this crisis and affirms the need for a holistic, integrated, and radical response, one which recognizes the interconnectedness and value of all living things. To quote the encyclical, "Doomsday predictions can no longer be met with irony and disdain. The pace of consumption, waste, and environmental change has so stretched the planet's capacity that our contemporary lifestyle, unsustainable as it is, can only precipitate catastrophes, such as those which even now periodically occur in different parts of the world. The effects of the present imbalance can only be reduced by our decisive action here and now." End of quote. At the same time, Laudato Si avoids any kind of sort of bleak catastrophism or fatalism. Instead, it offers hope, hope based on God's sustaining and redeeming work. Thus, ecocide, as some fear, is not inevitable. To quote the encyclical, hope, the Pope says, would have us recognize that there is always a way out, that we can always redirect our steps. Gestures of generosity, solidarity, and care cannot but well up within us, since we are made to love. God has created the universe out of nothing and can also intervene in this world and overcome every form of evil. Injustice is not invincible. End of quote. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, offers a similar assessment. And I quote, he said, "God's faithfulness stands, assuring us that even in the most appalling disaster, love will not let go." But he also adds an important qualification to suggest that God might intervene to protect us from the corporate folly of our practices is as unchristian and unbiblical as to suggest that he protects us from the results of individual folly or sin. This is not a creation, Williams writes, in which there are no real risks. Our Christian faith has always held that the inexhaustible love of God cannot compel justice or virtue. We are capable of doing immeasurable damage to ourselves as individuals, and it seems clear that we have the same terrible freedom as a human race. A few words about the language of the encyclical. The encyclical is written in a very vigorous style. It is poignant, compelling, even haunting in places. It speaks of humanity's ill-considered exploitation, tragic consequences, a spiral of self-destruction, degradation, debasement, disfigurement, contamination, greed, wastefulness, and the potential for an ecological catastrophe under the explosion of industrial civilization. Using the metaphorical language of St. Francis of Assisi, the encyclical personifies nature. It speaks of the earth, our common home, being, quote, like a sister with whom we share our life, and a beautiful mother who opens her arms to embrace us. Yet this sister, Pope Francis asserts, and I quote, now cries out to us because of the harm we have inflicted on her by our irresponsible use and abuse of the goods with which God has endowed her. We have come to see ourselves as her lords and masters, entitled to plunder her at will. The violence present in our hearts, wounded by sin, is also reflected in the symptoms of sickness evident in the soil, in the water, in the air, and in all forms of life. This is why the earth herself, burdened and laid waste, is among the most abandoned and maltreated of our poor. We have forgotten that we are the dust of the earth. Some wonderful, evocative words there. Well, the Pope's reference to mother and father, it seems to me, sorry, and sister in this case, is significant. It is more than simply a rhetorical device. It highlights humanity's close relationship with the rest of nature. And Nicola was talking about this just before dinner. Our bodies are composed of the same stardust as every other form of life that has existed on this planet and probably in the universe over billions of years. Likewise, much of our DNA is similar to other animals, about 95% in the case of chimpanzees. Personifying nature not only reminds us of that, but it also affects our emotional and psychological engagement. It frames reality in ways that can elicit a greater identification and sympathy with the suffering of God's creatures, thereby provoking a stronger and more heartfelt response. Identification and sympathy matter. If democratic governments are to respond effectively to the ecological crisis, pardon me, enough citizens must care about the natural world. Seeing the creation and creatures in terms of mothers and sisters may encourage such care, at least for those who value motherhood and sisterhood. But I would just note, it did disturb me that the Prime Minister, the current Prime Minister, said during the election campaign that most New Zealanders weren't too troubled or something like that by climate change, weren't much concerned about climate change, I think were his words, which he may be right, but of course, to the extent that that is true, it is part of his responsibility as Prime Minister to change that state of affairs. The language of the encyclical also helps citizens to understand the interconnectedness and mutual dependence of all forms of life. It encourages people to think in terms of systems and to recognise that humanity is an integral part of nature. Human beings are not above, outside, or beyond the natural realm. As Pope Francis reminds us, our physical bodies consist of the creation's elements. We breathe her air, he says, and we receive life and refreshment from her waters. We are creatures. We are a fundamental part of the community of creation. The New Testament scholar Richard Borkham, who came here a few years ago, puts it this way. Humans are not demigods, set like God above creation, but creatures among other creatures, dependent like other creatures on the material world of which they are part, and in which they are immersed in a web of reciprocal relationships with other creatures. So this understanding, which is at the heart, it seems to me, of the encyclical, is really quite fundamental, that human beings need to see themselves as part of creation, as creatures, not in some sort of godlike role controlling creation. Now, Lynn White's famous article, which is to some extent the basis for this conference today, is clearly relevant in this context. White argued, as many of you will know, quite strongly, drawing heavily on the ideas of St. Francis of Assisi at the end of his paper, that nature has intrinsic worth, a worth endowed by God. It is not simply instrumentally valuable. To quote White, we shall, he argued, continue to have a worsening ecologic crisis until we reject the, he calls, Christian axiom, well, this is debatable, the Christian axiom that nature has no reason for existence save to serve man. Laudato Si offers a broadly similar perspective. It recognises that how human beings see and value nature has a profound impact on our behaviour. Well, there are many other aspects of Laudato Si that resonate strongly, certainly with me. One of these is the powerful connection which Pope Francis draws between the need for ecological justice and the need for social justice, including the relationship specifically between climate justice and serving the poor. As he argues, humanity ought to be concerned for every part of creation that is weak, poor, vulnerable, or suffering. In this regard, Pope Francis draws very heavily on the inspiration of his, if you like, mentor in some ways, St. Francis of Assisi, the 13th century Italian monk. St. Francis demonstrated how we should show our creaturely love and care, not only for the needy and marginalized amongst humanity, but also for everything that God has created, everything that is fragile and defenseless, everything that needs our loving protection. As the Pope underscores, St. Francis of Assisi demonstrated through his life and teaching the inseparable bonds that link a concern for nature, justice for the poor, commitment to society, and interior peace. Ecological concern and wise environmental stewardship must go hand in hand with the pursuit of social justice. The two are inextricably linked. After all, if we fail to protect nature, it will be the poor, as it is already, who suffer most from the loss of ecosystem services, from the severe droughts and storms which lie ahead, from rising sea levels and so forth. I just witnessed in recent weeks the terrible suffering of the people of the Caribbean as a result of the hurricanes Irma and Maria, or think of the terrible suffering in recent years in Fiji and Vanuatu and other Pacific Island states from Cyclone Winston and Pam. The impacts on the poor are significantly greater in terms of the consequences than they are for rich countries, which have much greater capacity to recover. Finally, just a comment about the strong case that the encyclical makes for what are called new models of global development, new ways of assessing social and economic progress, and reform modes of governance that are more far-sighted and capable, in the Pope's words, of new integral and interdisciplinary thinking. To quote Pope Francis, he says, "Put simply, it is a matter of redefining our notion of progress. A technological and economic development which does not leave in its wake a better world and an integrally higher quality of life cannot be considered progress. Frequently, in fact, people's quality of life actually diminishes by the deterioration of the environment, the low quality of food, and the depletion of resources in the midst of economic growth." In other words, he's making the point that a very strong focus on just a very narrow range of indicators, or even one like GDP, is really quite inappropriate, and we need to have a broad, richer understanding of what progress involves. But that, of course, does beg many questions. What are the appropriate criteria and performance indicators for measuring progress? And how do we ensure that governments, in an age of populism, impatience, and democratic myopia, take a broad range of measures seriously? Perhaps it's expecting too much of a papal encyclical to answer such questions, but I think Pope Francis could have ventured a little bit further, moving from some general propositions to a bit more explicit guidance and specific recommendations. And it's at that point now I want to turn to some of the weaknesses in the encyclical. Numerous criticisms have been made by scholars from a range of different disciplines, including many of his fellow Catholic theologians. Not all these criticisms, in my view, are fair or well-founded, but some, I think, are. And here are three that I would like to just cover in the final part of my lecture tonight. First of all, the encyclical fails to engage adequately with the academic literature in the natural, physical, and social sciences, and more generally fails to draw explicitly on mainstream scientific evidence. Second, the encyclical blames the ecological crisis largely on the market economy, and argues that consumerism and the market economy are inherently linked. And I think both of those claims are questionable, or at least deserve interrogation. And third, the encyclical rejects market mechanisms to mitigate environmental problems like climate change. Again, a claim which I feel needs close scrutiny. So let me briefly expand on these three concerns. First of all, academic disciplines tend to be siloed. As an academic, I'm very well aware of that. If we take for a moment theology and politics, political theorists and political philosophers, from my experience, rarely read or cite works in the field of political theology, unless they're quite ancient, like maybe Aquinas or Augustine. Equally, theologians with an interest in political issues, leaving aside a few notable exceptions in this room, typically engage only modestly with the work of leading political scientists and philosophers. The same dichotomy, in my view, inhabits the encyclical. The distinguished Yale economist William Nordhaus, who I have to say I don't always agree with, but in this case I'm going to quote him to defend my view, in a thoughtful article on the encyclical in the New York Review of Books a few months after its publication, commented as follows. He said, "In reading the encyclical, one senses the struggle of an ancient institution immersed in its doctrine and history, slowly and incompletely adapting to modern science. Its quotations and references are virtually entirely to the pronouncements of earlier popes or others in the church hierarchy. There are very few references to secular environmental documents, such as the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and no references to scientific studies. Similarly, there is much discussion about economics, finance, and inequality, but no citations of any data or sources." Now, I realise that this is standard fare with respect to encyclicals. So Laudato Si is not an exception. But this raises questions of fundamental importance about how the Christian community, and especially its leaders and scholars, interact with the global research community across the natural, physical, and social sciences. As it stands, the two worlds are often divorced. They operate, it seems, as parallel tracks, rather like a motorway here and a railway line there, running alongside each other, but not interacting. These two bodies of work deal with the same issues and challenges, they occupy the same world, but they do so separately and often in splendid isolation. The first track, of course, is the Christian Church and its largely in-house scholarly community. Its focus tends to be inward rather than outward. It only briefly engages with scientific evidence or so-called secular thinking, and typically only when it is thought safe to do so or when there is really no option. The other track is the vast global research community, I guess, of which I'm part. Now, I hope I'm part of both in some ways. The scientists and scholars in this latter world rarely seek out the views of the church or its leading scholars and theologians and rarely cite their work. And I know there are exceptions to that. But papal encyclicals do not grace the course outlines of university programs, except perhaps in theology and religious studies. And if I'm wrong, I'd love to have some exceptions to that. Can these parallel tracks not be brought together? Can the two communities of faith and science not interact to a greater extent? Is there any reason why papal encyclicals cannot quote robust scientific evidence in the same way that they quote the Bible and leading Christian scholars or saints of the past or present? Is not the book of nature as relevant as the books of scripture? And is not God the author of both? And if I had time, which I don't, I would want to make exactly the same point, in my view, not just about papal encyclicals, but more generally the preaching and teaching life of the church. It is far too rare in my experience, and I don't want to single out any particular individual church or denomination, but it's far too rare in my experience for the preaching community of the church to deal with major contemporary issues. Ask yourself the question, when did you last hear a sermon on the fourth industrial revolution and the implications of artificial intelligence for humanity? Perhaps the most significant technological change in human history. We are simply not grappling with important issues. And I know when I last spoke at a conference of this nature 6 years ago, I then preached a sermon the following day at St. John's on a theology of environmental care, or creation care. And I can still remember to this day someone coming up to me and saying, "Oh gosh, you wouldn't have been allowed to preach that sermon in my church." As if somehow, you know, creation care was not part of the gospel. Okay, a second concern is the tendency of Laudato Si to blame the market economy for the current ecological crisis and the related tendency to blame compulsive consumerism on market forces. Unlike Lynn White, Pope Francis does not lay the ecological crisis primarily at the feet of misguided Christian theology, such as an emphasis on humanity's domination over nature, rather than, for example, a responsibility for good stewardship. Significantly, too, he gives little attention to the environmental damage inflicted by humanity long before the emergence of modern market economies. If he'd visited New Zealand 200 or 300 years ago, it would have been evident to him that already, before market economies were active, significant ecological damage was already being done. Equally, he ignores the huge scarred wastelands or the grossly polluted rivers and lakes of China, Russia, and North Korea, which have resulted from decades of communist-inspired state planning. Rather, his focus is on the ecological damage wrought by dark market forces. The encyclical criticizes those who, quote, are obsessed with maximizing profits, and it rejects what it calls, quote, a magical conception of the market, which would suggest the problems can be solved simply by an increase in the profits of companies or individuals. A view that I must say, it would be very, very hard to find someone who defends that. Certainly in the academic community. The encyclical goes on to say, as long as production is increased, little concern is given to whether it is at the cost of future resources or the health of the environment. As long as the curing of a forest increases production, no one calculates the losses entailed in the desertification of the land, the harm done to biodiversity, or the increased pollution. In a word, business profit is by calculating and paying only for a fraction of the costs involved. In a word, business is profit by calculating and paying only a fraction of the costs involved. Well, it is true that businesses can and often do profit at the expense of the environment. No one would doubt that. But they can equally profit from operating within a regulatory framework that properly protects natural capital and ecosystem services. Moreover, in the long term, economic progress and commercial profitability will only be possible if nations protect their environments. There is no choice in the long run. The problem, then, is not that the market economy is evil or that profits are wicked. Rather, the roots of the ecological crisis, in my view, lie in human greed and the failure of governments to regulate economic activity effectively so that harmful environmental effects, or what economists call negative environmental externalities, are properly priced and prevented altogether. Put differently, in most cases, environmental degradation has been caused by a combination of market failures and government failures. Market prices have not reflected the environmental and social harm that various economic activities have been causing, and governments too often have failed to rectify that problem, and in New Zealand we see that writ large. The reasons for such government failures are not hard to identify. For instance, powerful commercial interests such as fossil fuel companies and agribusiness in New Zealand, Fonterra, have lobbied against effective environmental regulation, and governments, fearful of electoral defeat, have lacked the political will to act. In short, near-term interests have prevailed over long-term interests, and long-term environmental pain has been inflicted on the altar of short-term economic gain. Of course, governments would not be fearful of electoral defeat if citizens cared enough about their future interests and those of future generations, or if they placed a sufficiently high value on environmental goods and ecosystem services. So again, the issue comes back to the question of what people value. Markets largely reflect what people value and the choices they make. They do not cause such values or operate independently of human choices, although we must not underestimate the importance of manipulative advertising and commercially inspired assaults on truth and reason. In short, blaming markets for the ecological crisis is questionable. Rather, we should blame business leaders, investors, voters, and governments. To some extent, the encyclical recognizes this. It talks, for instance, about a lack of honesty, courage, and responsibility, and observes that countries have demonstrated what it calls a failure of conscience and responsibility. But the encyclical's tendency to lay the planet's environmental woes at the feet of markets and capitalism, in my view, is problematic. At the very least, it's not a complete understanding of the issues. And this brings me to my third and final point. If the problem definition and diagnosis is faulty, then the recommended treatment is also likely to be faulty. As noted at the beginning of my lecture, Pope Francis argues that the primary cause of the ecological crisis, and especially climate change, is the operation of market forces and their impact on consumer behaviour. Hence, he rejects using market mechanisms to solve the problem. In particular, he opposes any reliance on emissions trading schemes like what we have in New Zealand, or the use of carbon credits, which have been used internationally in an attempt to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. Let me quote. He says, "A strategy of buying and selling carbon credits can lead to a new form of speculation, which would not help reduce the emissions of polluting gases worldwide. This system seems to provide a quick and easy solution under the guise of a certain commitment to the environment, but in no way does it allow for the radical change which present circumstances require. Rather, it may simply become a ploy which permits maintaining the excessive consumption of some countries and sectors." Now, understandably, such comments have been criticised by many leading economists, including people like Professor Robert Stavins of Harvard University, who I know. The issues surrounding climate change mitigation are complex and time is short, so I'll just make some very quick comments. First one is this. Church leaders like popes and archbishops clearly have a right and responsibility to comment from time to time on important policy matters and societal problems, including the relative merits of the possible solutions to those problems. After all, policymaking raises significant ethical issues, and church leaders like popes must address such issues. Hence, Pope Francis's willingness to comment on ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is welcome. It would be wrong for such grave policy issues to be somehow out of bounds. He is also correct to argue that policies should serve the common good, and that any valid conception of the common good must include the interests of future generations. Second, papal pronouncements on specific policy matters should be informed by the best available empirical evidence. Unfortunately, the encyclical makes little effort to engage with such evidence. It relies instead solely on assertions. Many economists have disputed these assertions, and in my view, their concerns are justified. Third, and related to this, designing policies to remedy serious societal problems generally requires trade-offs. Some of these are intra-generational, others are inter-generational. Often, too, there is much uncertainty and complexity. Typically, every option that's available to governments has weaknesses and adverse impacts. This is certainly true of all climate change policies. Every available option is problematic to one degree or another, economically, politically, or in other ways. That is why economists and many others continue to debate the relative merits of emissions trading schemes and emission taxes, for example, and why they also continue to debate the relative merits of so-called price-based mechanisms like emission trading schemes and non-price-based mechanisms such as regulation. Those debates are bound to continue because there are good arguments always. And I guess the critical point is that every instrument has pros and cons. Every instrument can be well implemented or badly implemented. Sadly, many emissions trading schemes around the world, including the one in New Zealand, have not been well implemented. The one here has had serious flaws, and most of those have been driven by policy decisions to protect certain interests. Hence, they have not been as effective as they were intended to be. Now, it seems to me that when church leaders and theologians and ethicists comment on complex matters regarding policy, they need to be mindful of the multiple challenges that face policymakers. Theology has a vital role to play in public debate, but theological reflection must take seriously such factors as uncertainty, risk, political constraints, and administrative complexity. Merely stating high-level ethical principles is not enough, nor is it acceptable to ignore the problem of trade-offs. Finally, it's worth noting that an ethical case can be made against emission trading schemes and related schemes that involve the trading of pollution rights in a market context. For instance, the Harvard political philosopher Michael Sandel has written extensively about the moral limits and the corrupting influence of market mechanisms of this kind. But unfortunately, the encyclical does not do justice to Sandel's arguments. Well, it doesn't even mention them, or those of other scholars. Equally important, it fails to address the various objections to Sandel's arguments, not least the view that all the alternative options are ethically inferior. So we have a really critical problem here. The Pope has very explicitly criticized specific ways of solving the climate crisis, but does not really provide good justifications for those criticisms, and does not address the problems with the alternatives. And as a result, he opened himself up to pretty scathing criticisms from a significant body of very distinguished economists around the world, particularly in the US and the United Kingdom. Now, I've run out of time. I had a few other comments I wished to make about other matters. I will pass on those, and I will just simply come to a very quick conclusion.
Jonathan, you can add a few minutes if you...
It's okay. No, no, everyone here is probably... It's only a page. All right. Okay. All right. Well, I just don't want to. Inflict agony on you any longer. Okay. Safeguarding the future. There is a further matter that deserves mention, and which the encyclical, unsurprisingly, doesn't address, but which I think is really absolutely crucial, and that is the question: how do we enhance the capacity of democratic political systems, and indeed political systems more generally, to address important long-term issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, the fourth industrial revolution, and many other the big things that are affecting our futures. In recent years, I've written several books and many papers on these sorts of questions, and I'll not attempt to repeat my arguments or reform proposals here, but I would like to make a plea for more attention to be given to the design of our public institutions, including those in both the executive and the legislative branches. For instance, we currently have a parliamentary commissioner for the environment, and indeed Jan Wright spoke at a seminar yesterday that I chaired at the university, and she and her successor, Simon Upton, in 10 days' time, has a mandate to speak on behalf of environmental interests. And the three commissioners we've had to date have all been bold in speaking out on behalf of environmental interests. One might say, sadly, with less impact than one would like. But nonetheless, they have spoken truth to power and done so vigorously. But we have no equivalent independent commissioner to speak for future generations on non-environmental issues, for example, or to undertake the critical task of foresight, including horizon scanning, scenario analysis, risk assessment, and so on. Similarly, our current modes of performance monitoring and assessment tend to focus on narrow flow measures like GDP, rather than on changes in capital stocks, such as renewable and non-renewable natural capital. Equally, we concentrate on things like the net level of public debt, but have no measures of our comprehensive wealth as a country. That is, measures which incorporate all forms of capital: financial, manufactured, human, intellectual, social, and natural. What we measure matters. What is not measured is often ignored or downplayed. This must change. In short, we need stronger institutional voices to safeguard our long-term interests and more comprehensive ways of embedding the future in our day-to-day policymaking processes. To put it differently, we need to find ways to bring the long-term into short-term political focus in a way that incentivizes democratic political leaders to give adequate weight to protecting our future interests and those of future generations. And just as an aside on that, one little parallel thought, maybe. During the election campaign, I was intrigued that there was a debate between the Prime Minister and Jacinda Ardern about which party was going to most benefit older voters. Bill English was extolling the virtues of the tax changes that his government has legislated, but they've yet to be implemented, and that older people, 65 and plus, were going to be X dollars better off each week. And Jacinda Ardern responded by saying, no, if Labour won, older voters would be better off because there was going to be this, winter fuel subsidy, and there were going to be all these other things. I thought, goodness, this is not really very helpful. I sent a text to Jacinda and I said, for goodness sake, focus on getting old people to think about the interests of their grandchildren, not about whether they're going to be a few dollars a week better off if you win. Well, she actually replied saying, yes, good point, but didn't seem to make any difference. Anyway, there we go. This is true. Mary can vouch for that. All right, so to sum up, sometimes my students wonder if these stories are true. Did you really talk to the Prime Minister? Yes, I did, actually. Did he really say something to you? Yes, he did, actually. I'll tell you a story about Winston Peters, but that would not be probably polite in this company. Okay, all right. Okay, to finish, humanity faces an unprecedented environmental crisis. Laudato Si correctly recognises the gravity of this crisis. It rightly laments humanity's culpability, and it fittingly offers a timely, powerful, and passionate call to arms. Whatever the limitations and weaknesses of the encyclical, Pope Francis is absolutely correct in urging Christians, and indeed all people of goodwill, to act faithfully and responsibly to tackle the crisis. This includes thoughtful and effective responses at all levels by citizens, congregations, communities, businesses, and governments. Here in New Zealand, there is much, much work to do. Recent governments, and I don't mean just the current one, have failed to provide adequate leadership. Businesses have too often prioritised their short-term profits over the long-term common good or even the long-term well-being of their own organisations. Meanwhile, many citizens appear unconcerned and apathetic, while many Christians remain, in my view, asleep in the light, or even deliberately keeping the light off. Humanity needs, as Pope John Paul II rightly said, an ecological conversion and an environmental reformation. Laudato Si powerfully illuminates this need. Pope Francis deserves our grateful thanks. Amen.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. And it's not the last we'll hear from Jonathan tonight, so I'll invite Jonathan to take a seat at the table. This is the table for our distinguished panel tonight. Two of the others have been introduced before, Nicola, if you could come forward, and also Derek. And also our fourth panelist is Richard Story, who is the founder of Arosha, and you're the one that hasn't been introduced.
I think you're confusing me with somebody else. Yeah.
Founder of Arosha, New Zealand.
Oh, well, okay, yeah, Arosha, New Zealand. Yeah. Richard is a, I'll see if you can correct me if I'm wrong about any of these details, but Richard is a freshwater ecologist with NIWA, based in Hamilton, where he lives with his wife Lisa and two young children. Yep. Anything else I need to say about you? Okay. Great. So we'll just basically kick off with questions from the audience for the panel. And the first question can come from me.
I can take that right. I'm just interested, Jonathan, you mentioned a number of the publicity responses to the Pope's work, and in terms of obviously in the Guardian, etc. So there's a number of things that, of course, it has gone very wide in terms of the publicity. But I'm wondering about the assessment for any of you on the actual effect of it beyond just the publicity. But what have you seen happen or not happen as a result?
Well, a few quick comments from me, and then I'll be most interested in what others have to say. The encyclical, as people will be aware, was published 6 months before the Paris Climate Change Conference at the end of 2015, and it was strategically timed with that in mind. There's no question that the encyclical was welcomed by many political leaders and by many of those involved in the environmental movement and those involved with the United Nations climate change talks. So the Secretary General of the UNFCCC made a very positive comment about having these sorts of reflections from the Pope, and her remarks were echoed repeatedly from my recollection several years ago around the world. And there was a view expressed by many people who I suspect have no particular faith commitment themselves that it was important and helpful to have religious leaders like the Pope making these sorts of statements. Of course, the Pope wasn't alone. There were similar statements made by the leaders of most Christian denominations and groups of denominations, and also, of course, by the leaders of Islamic communities and Buddhist communities and the Dalai Lama and so on. So how do you assess the impact of these sorts of statements? It's very, very difficult. I mean, I would simply say the Pope's contribution added to the wider kind of what you might call movement of civil society to pressure political leaders to make the Paris summit a success. But what's the precise contribution is difficult to say. The other quick comment would be that obviously it was a document which generated debate, particularly within the Catholic community, and there would be many conservative Catholics in the United States who distanced themselves from the Pope, including political figures, senators, congressmen, and so forth, along with more conservative-leaning Catholic theologians and others. So it would be fair to say that, well, I don't know if anyone's seen any polling evidence, but given the result of the presidential election in the United States 18 months later, it clearly didn't have a particularly dramatic effect on the Christian vote generally. We know that about 80% of evangelicals voted for Trump, and I think the Catholic, clearly the majority of Catholics voted for Trump. So, I wouldn't have thought the Pope would have voted for Trump given his public comments.
They probably voted for Trump because of abortion rather than
Trump. Yeah, I mean, I don't have a whole lot to, excuse me, to add to what Jonathan said, but assessing the effects of things like papal encyclicals and other non-commodified human activities where there aren't units produced and purchased is incredibly hard. I would just say to think about it this way. We call the Pope the Holy Father. And as a parent, I often wonder if my children ever listen to a single thing I say. But then every once in a while, without expectation, they do or say something and you realize, holy cow, they do. So I think sort of multiplied on an institutional global scale of, say, the Catholic Christian family, the Holy Father might wonder if his children are listening. But then again, you might look around the world here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, or somewhere else, and see a community or congregation of Catholics doing something either explicitly and self-consciously under the inspiration of the encyclical, or just intrinsically and sort of organically harmonious with it. And, you know, like I'm a parent of two sons, the Holy Father might chuckle look to himself and say, well, the children were listening. So it's just a real trick to quantify the impact of something like this.
Nicola, Richard? Or?
So there's a microphone coming to you.
Measurability, principally to Jonathan. I see that the Bhutanese have a concept of gross national happiness. I just wondered whether you and the other members of the panel are convinced that all the relevant factors going to assessment of our care for creation and care to promote the environment and to rectify the problems that you've itemized, whether they can all be measured and in some sense reduced to at least approximate numbers for comparative purposes?
Well, that's a very simple answer. No, they can't. but there are many things that can be measured that we aren't measuring, and there is a very good case for us doing our very best to improve the quality of our measurement and the comprehensiveness of our measurement. Clearly, not everything that matters can be measured, nor can everything that matters have a dollar value put on it. In fact, it could be argued that putting a dollar value on some things actually undermines the value, because the value is in the infinite. But Don, I mean, around the world there is considerable work going on in major international institutions, the World Bank, the OECD, the UN Statistical Office, etc., etc., trying to improve the way in which we measure, particularly natural capital and the contribution of natural capital or ecosystem services to economic activity. This is really complex conceptually, methodologically, ethically. There are clear limits. But the problem we've got at the moment is that, you know, we can talk about GDP going up, but if we're not measuring the damage we're doing to ecosystem services, we're not measuring the harmful consequences of our actions, which may be significantly more, if you can quantify and put a dollar value on, than the improvement in GDP. Years ago, the Chinese, very courageously in some ways, this is back in 2004, attempted to develop a green GDP measure in which they measured GDP in the normal way, under normal UN statistical methods. And then they said, okay, let's now try and put a value on the cost of the environmental damage we're doing. And they didn't cover all forms of environmental damage, but they tried to identify a range of damages, and then the cost of clearing up the mess that was being made, the damage to soil, the damage to rivers, the damage to aquifers, and so on. And considerable work was done, and some green GDP figures were published, which highlighted that whereas if you looked at GDP, China was growing at whatever, 8, 9, 10% per annum, if you looked at real green GDP, it was only 3 or 4%. And that didn't include all the damage that was being done. And so horrified were the leaders of these results that they canned the project.
So not so courageous at the end?
Not so courageous. But it was very revealing.
Yes.
It was very revealing.
Yeah. I think the UN has recently put a figure of almost 10% on, or 10% less of GDP because of Chinese pollution as well. I just read that the other day. There's a few numbers coming out now. Yeah. Anyone else? Question at the back.
Thank you. In terms of attitudes and worldviews that might be perceived to have a negative attitude towards the environment, Anglican scholar Tom Wright has talked about what he calls Platonized eschatology. In other words, if you ask most Christians what their view of the Christian destiny is, it is to leave the earth and go to a place called heaven. At the same time, you have the very, very influential writing of Augustine, who wrote about the city of God, in which the church was seen as the city of God, when in fact, when we understand the Bible's teaching on new creation, the kingdom of God on earth is holistic and includes in fact all the creation, animals and plants and human beings as well. So it seems to me that You know, if the Pope is going to be talking about attitudes and world views, it seems to me that that's one contributing factor. It's just my take on it, be interested to know what you think.
Well, I'm interested in what others think. The encyclical doesn't deal in detail with the new creation. It hints, and there's some sort of evocative language in various places. But I think it says enough to make it very clear to anyone reading it that he would not agree with a Platonized eschatology, to use the terminology of Tom Wright, indeed anything but. But one could argue that the encyclical could have done a little more to counter some very bad sort of eschatologies. And it does disturb me that there are still so many Christians who seem to think that we don't need to worry too much about the hearing before creation, because yes, it's all going to come to an end, it's all going to be wrapped up when Christ returns or whatever, and therefore it doesn't matter. And apart from anything else, there are other people here who are far more expert theologically than me, but amongst other things, it fails to recognise the critical importance of the incarnation, that God became flesh, stardust in our midst, which, if nothing else, tells us something about the critical value that God places on the world that God has made. Quite apart from all the other aspects that are relevant in this context.
I agree to some extent, but I think that we have to do the work of saving the planet or whatever it is we do, regardless of our eschatology, because that's such a complicated issue. And I mean, Christ did become human and took on stardust, but then he turned into this complicated resurrected body as well, and so it's not quite as clear cut as some of the unplatonic people think it is, I think. But I think nevertheless it's our task to do this work of regeneration anyway, whatever our eschatology
is. We believe in the resurrection of the body.
Yes, but in a very odd way.
Yeah, very odd. Yes. I hope mine's a bit better.
Jonathan, you mentioned Prime Minister English saying that New Zealanders aren't particularly concerned about climate change. Do we have any indication at all that Prime Minister English has an awareness of Laudato Si? And the second part of the question is Laudato Si actually the way to engage him in a conversation about climate change?
Well, look, there are Catholics in this room that might have a simple answer to that. The first part of your question, whether or not Bill English is aware of Laudato Si, I imagine he is. He is a devout Catholic, and it would be very strange indeed for him not to be aware of a papal encyclical of this significance. Whether he's read it is another matter. Whether if he read it, it would influence his views, I'm not very sure, to be honest. My impression of Bill English goes back to the very first major conference I ran on climate change in 2006, March 2006, and he then was no longer leader of the opposition. I think he was opposition spokesperson on education. But he came to the conference, and he stood in the shadows at the back of the Te Papa. What's the theatre there? Soundings Theatre. He stood at the back in the shadows. It was almost as if he didn't want to be seen there, nor to be identified with what was going on. And I know that I organised the conference. I saw him at the back, and I actually went up to him at the back in the shadows. And ever since then, I've had this sense of him being in the shadows. To my knowledge, he's never given a speech
on climate change. Mind you, his predecessor never gave a major speech on climate change. And in all his years as Prime Minister, John Key only mentioned climate change once in his 8 State of the Nation speeches. And it was 8 words. 8 words. So that told you how little significance that John Key placed on climate change. And my impression is that Bill prefers not to be a problem and probably hopes that he's not going to have to make any of the hard, really hard decisions. That's my sense. I suspect he's not a skeptic, but I don't think he really understands or is prepared to accept the full sort of magnitude of the challenge we face. If he did, I'm sure he'd be more energised about it. And I was mindful that, and this is partly because we had the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment speaking yesterday, that when she released her report on sea level rise at the end of 2015, was it the end of 2016? 2015, I think. Bill English, then as Minister of Finance, responded that, in his view, the matter, i.e. sea level rise, was, quote, too speculative for us to do anything about. And I was so shocked. I sent him an email, and Nick Smith, saying, look, for goodness sake, we can be as certain about sea level rise as we can be about just about anything else. We have a 99% probability that the sea level is going to continue to rise. It's been rising, for a very long time. It's going to continue to rise, and it's accelerating. The suggestion that this is, quite too speculative for governments to be concerned about is just unbelievable. We're not dealing with sort of 10% probabilities here. We're dealing with an extremely high level of probability. And for those of you who live on the Capital Coast or in South Dunedin or anywhere like that, the sea level coming to your time, your place, anytime soon, I'm sorry.
Good. Can you put your hand up again, sir?
Professor, thank you for your presentation. In your lecture, you mentioned about higher quality of life at the expense of environment. I have a concern. When we have technological advancement, we pollute the environment by creating more carbon footprint. And natural disaster like flood, like hurricane, all that will affect life and property. So if you do a mathematics, not to make so much profit, take care more of the environment, to avoid natural disaster that costs taxpayer money. Would this work? What is your opinion?
I'm not sure if I fully understood the question, but if I did, it is that environmental effects are going to have significant economic consequences, and that this will affect overall economic performance and impact on governments and so on. If that's the case, of course, yes. And if you were simply taking a fairly hard-nosed economic sort of perspective, and you were only really concerned about sort of government's fiscal interests, and you weren't concerned about the loss of species and so on, in my view, you would still need to be concerned about climate change because of the long-term economic, including fiscal, costs that it's going to impose. Sea level rise, for example, is going to be enormously costly for this country. We are surrounded by coasts, and they're all going to be, to one degree or another, affected by sea level rise, with flooding and inundation, erosion, and so on. And that is going to affect literally tens of thousands of people, tens of thousands of properties this century, probably well over 100,000 people. It could be hundreds of thousands over the coming centuries, almost irrespective now of what we do in terms of global emissions, sadly. There are possible scenarios in which maybe the worst-case scenarios of sea level rise will be avoided if, for example, we can remove large quantities of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. But we're a long way from doing that. And others may have a view on this.
Down the front here.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I've just arrived for the lecture, so people may have covered this earlier in the day. But
I've heard several times in the last few months the statement, first from Noam Chomsky in the New York Times interview a few months ago, that the greatest existential threats to us these days are two. There's nuclear war and there's climate change. And then Rakesh Thakur, who is who used to be the Deputy General Secretary of the UN, saying the same thing, but he said nuclear weapons will kill you quicker. I suppose my question is, I feel as a kind of newcomer to issues of climate change, and to some degree nuclear weapons as well, that I work on a bit professionally, nuclear weapons stuff, that quite frequently we try to terrify people into being involved in these issues. And I wonder if our natural reaction to being terrified is to get as far as we possibly can, hopefully in the rapture, and so I wonder what the alternatives are to terrifying people into awareness, into action on these issues. I wonder about, for example, theology of grace, which where we respond to grace and the fact that actually we most of us have far more than we deserve, and can we respond to that? Or whether there's other kinds of options besides expecting people to be terrified into action.
Well, look, let me make a brief comment, and then I'll be interested in what others have to say. It seems to me, Becky, that different people are going to respond to different kinds of narratives. And we know this from quite a wide range of literature now, specifically on climate change, that different audiences respond differently. So there are many Americans, for example, who, if they're told this is ecologically desirable, won't do it because they think being ecologically desirable is bad. So,
there's
yes, fake news. So it seems to me we have to recognize that different people respond differently to different, and fear and terror and so on may work for some people, but it won't work for others. Among the many, many other sorts of narratives which I think we need to press home strongly are the opportunities which climate change mitigation provides, and that includes healthier lifestyles, bicycles, electric cars, and so on. So for the commercially oriented, one could say, look, here are some terrific investment opportunities, and you might invest in electric cars, then you might want to buy one. And so on. I'm not trying to be facetious here, I'm actually being quite serious. I think we need to try and pull all the available stops, if you like, doing so, however, with absolute integrity and honesty. Different messages are going to work with different audiences.
Yeah, well, I agree. I
mean,
I think that theology of grace is wonderful, but we have so many things to do, so many urgent things to do, in our lives that are distractions, that we probably do need a little bit to be scared as well in order to be motivated to do things. And obviously, as somebody earlier was talking about the Goldilocks zone of fear, a little bit but not too much, and that's probably about it.
You don't want people paralyzed. And you certainly don't want to get... I mean, I do find some of the students, can get really quite deeply concerned about this. And one anxiety of mine is that this will contribute to that kind of either withdrawal or, at worst, serious depression and potential suicide. The future is bleak and hopeless. There's nothing to live for. It's only going to get worse. And actually, I do think, as a Christian community, there is an absolutely critical role here in terms of speaking about hope in a proper way that Andrew was earlier today. Not a hope that's a false hope, a simple optimism, but a hope that's deeply rooted in a suffering God.
I think also, I agree that people are motivated by different things and a little bit of fear is helpful. I think the other thing is that we all need to know what some of the solutions are as well. And there's a lot of analysis that goes into describing problems in great detail. But it seems to me often when solutions are presented, they're presented with much less analysis, sort of almost hand-wavy type things, or you might do this or you could do that. But I think it's really helpful when people actually analyse the solutions in as much depth and detail as they have analysed the problems. There's a professor of geography at Massey University who used to be part of Arosha when he was a little younger. He's no longer able to be with us at meetings like this, a guy called John Flinley, who had done some of this analysis, and you know, he worked out how many trees each person would need to plant if we were to, you know, reduce greenhouse gases by a certain amount. And it's some of these things are actually quite achievable if you think, well, if I just did my little bit and I got my neighbour to do their bit. I personally find those things very motivating, you know, if you can bring down the solution to something achievable.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with this whole issue is that we get very little feedback and yet we're being asked to do quite a lot. And so that's why I thought it was interesting, you know, that the carbon dioxide, I was actually in a workshop when Stephen was showing how the carbon dioxide levels had actually been off, which is an important sort of feedback because it's very hard to keep changing the mic without
emission.
Yes.
Global emissions have.
Yeah.
We're unstable now for
3 years. Yeah, that's right, that's what you're saying. And it's hard to sort of keep changing your behaviour when you never get any feedback. And everything just gets worse.
One of the speakers this morning, Andrew Shepherd, did address that question, so we may probably be able to get his paper as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These will eventually be online as recordings, so give us a week or so to edit them up and get them posted, but you can get Andrew's talk, and he spoke, I think, quite perceptively on this.
Great. Selwyn?
Jonathan, you, early on in your paper, drew attention to the fact that the encyclical didn't seem to engage in any depth with economists or scientists, and you're worried about kind of siloing. And Nicola, you and I had a conversation earlier today about a similar kind of thing, how even many Christian scientists don't seem to be very interested in the theological implications of their work or how theology might impact on their science, that kind of conversation. I'm interested in how the four of you might see these more interdisciplinary conversations happening and what their significance might be.
I guess I would start by saying we probably need fora to be doing that, those kind of things, you know, conferences where they deliberately bring together theologians and scientists. I think in some ways they're working at different levels. Science can be done by a Christian without any reference to God at all, and we get very used to doing that. And I know some Christian scientists who are people of deep faith that I really respect, but when it comes to their science, they really make very little reference to God at all. But they can do, and I think it's when we bring the theologians and the scientists together that they start to see the opportunities to listen to each other and to work together. But there's very little opportunity for them to get together and hear each other in those ways. So I think that's probably the first thing we need to do is create those opportunities for dialogue.
Yeah. This is a tricky question, particularly when we're talking about people like Jonathan and Nicola and I who are academics, because the way that academics works is that you're rewarded for specialization, and the knowledges and the information that we're dealing with are so incredibly vast and complex, it's hard to get a handle on one of them, which is what you need to do to get a job, let alone get a handle on more than one of them. So the way I've talked about this with my students, the way I've talked about it with colleagues, and I've not yet had a chance to do the course, maybe Jonathan, you and I can gin this up sometime. I always thought it would be a fun course title to do something called Between Dogma and Data, you know, and sort of take the dogma as the theological component and the data as the empirical component, but we're talking about science or policy. And just raise that issue. I mean, in my own field of public theology and Christian ethics, we have in-house debates before we even get across the way to the neighbor's house, and there are people who do so-called applied ethics, data-driven ethics, and people on the other side that do dogmatic, that is, conceptual, theological, biblical, philosophical ethics. We kind of look askance at each other. And so I'm more of a dogma guy by training, and I tend to look at data people as if, oh, you do ethics by a show of hands. You just put up, you know, put out a survey, and whatever everybody says, that's what's right. And that's, of course, facetious. But then look at me and say, oh, you do ethics by just looking up at the sky and talking about what's good and true and beautiful, and it has nothing to do with anything at all. And so it's a real challenge to bring together expertise, experience, method, and technique that can really do a more full-orbed and adequate justice to some of these issues. And I think the thing I've found and the thing that I've worked on that's the best way to do that is to stop doing work by yourself and start working with other scholars, other practitioners, and don't try to do it all yourself. But that, again, requires this issue of the forum. Where is the place where that work can get done? You know, assuming you have the people who are willing to do it.
If there was a question at the back, I think we'll need to make that the last one. No? Okay, in that case, we have Bruce.
Thank you, Jonathan. Question to clarify your critique of the Pope. This is from a non-economist, are you suggesting that the Pope is mistakenly identifying the role of the market with a neoliberal model of the role of the market and therefore rejecting it on that basis? Is that the gist of what you're saying?
Well, I think that's one plausible interpretation. To be honest, the aspects of the encyclical are somewhat slippery, and claims and sort of generalizations are made that are not then grounded in subsequent argumentation. So that leaves one wondering in places what exactly the Pope meant. But I think there's enough in the encyclical in relation to the treatment of markets to say he seems to be interpreting the market within a broadly neoliberal lens, and by that I mean particularly a lens in which there is relatively light-handed regulation of any regulation at all, in which, therefore, in effect, the state is not doing its job to protect those interests that markets can't protect adequately on their own. But I think one would have to, do a more detailed scrutiny than I was able to do tonight to flesh some of that out, Bruce, carefully. What is very clear is his rejection of market-based instruments to address climate change, in particular greenhouse gas emissions. And my personal view is, while there are criticisms to be made, valid criticisms to be made of emissions trading schemes and emissions taxes as price-based mechanisms, a broad brush kind of denunciation is unwarranted. And that if we were being fair-minded about this, we would need to recognise that there are disadvantages with every available way of addressing the problem. I mean, we could simply say, okay, from 2025, you won't be able to buy a vehicle with an internal combustion engine. And after 2030, all vehicles with internal combustion engines will be scrapped. We could do that. Politically, it would be very difficult. And a government that announced it might well, lose the next election, so it might not last. And it would result in an enormous kind of loss of capital when all the vehicles that are, less than whatever, 10 years old, were scrapped. But it may be that we will need to do something like that. It may be. But the point is, there will be significant downsides, as there are with every instrument that the government has available to it.
Thank you. I have just seen a Catholic hand go up.
your assertion that Pope rejects market mechanisms, is that based solely on that paragraph about carbon credits, or is there more? I haven't read it recently, but I can't recall myself.
Yes, it's specifically about the rejection of market mechanisms in relation to climate change mitigation.
Specifically
about emission trading schemes.
Based on that,
he rejects carbon credits. And it's very difficult to run an emissions trading scheme without emission credits or carbon credits. I mean, that's sort of the heart of it. Yeah. You're basically saying, you know, we're going to quantify emissions by ton or something like that, and we're going to then marketize these units. And if you're an emitter, you have to buy credits to cover your emissions. And if you're a forester and you are carbon sink, then you're going to be able to sell to the people who are emitting and so on. You can't run an emission trading scheme without carbon credits or emission units. I mean, that's at the heart of it. It would be like trying to have a banking system without money.
No, my question, I was just wondering whether the that he rejects market mechanisms because it's just based on that paragraph about carbon credits. But also, my reading of that paragraph, I know it may be a matter of semantics, but it can be construed, in my view, that he's raising questions about it. It doesn't necessarily rule it out completely. I know there may be more.
No, that may be a fair comment, but then he doesn't.
You're right, he's saying comment. He doesn't justify.
No, he doesn't justify, he doesn't explore other options. And the tone of the encyclical in relation to the market is largely negative. There is no celebration, as say neoliberals would wish to have included, of the virtues of the market, whatever its vices, market economies. Let's face it, I mean, we are all beneficiaries of market economies here, and we've enjoyed phenomenal growth, notwithstanding the enormous ecological damage, but we're the beneficiaries of enormous economic growth, which has been largely driven not by governmental planning, communist, style public ownership of the means of production, distribution, and exchange. It's been largely through private ownership, private investment, people, being innovative, exchanging goods and services in the context of obviously a regulatory arrangement in which property is protected by the state and the transactions are regulated in various ways and so on and so on and so on, all of which is essential to a market economy. I felt reading the encyclical that the Pope was had an unduly sort of jaundiced view. And I think that probably partly reflects the context from which he comes of Argentina and the influence of liberation theology on Latin America in particular and people like him. And obviously in that context, the very real downside impacts of badly regulated markets, which include enormous exploitation, private coercion, corruption, inequality, environmental abuse, and so on. But you are right in probably cautioning me about my interpretation. But I do think if you read it as a whole, a fair-minded person would say the Pope probably wouldn't support an emissions trading scheme.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. And on the debate 2 years down the track to
heck so, right. So the lesson is don't criticise the Pope in front of the Okay, we'd better wrap it up there so that you can go home and get up in time to watch the All Blacks at 5 a.m. or whatever it is. Just remains to me to thank our panellists, Derek, Nicola, Jonathan and Richard. So thanks so much.